At first glance, the title of Marjorie Garber's new book, The Use and Abuse of Literature, seems pretty straightforward, but it actually introduces a question. Does literature have a use, and should it be expected to? Does it make people happier, better functioning, more compassionate? And what about its dark side? From the time Plato banned poets from the Republic, literature has been under suspicion. Ms. Garber's book is published by Pantheon. I'm very pleased it has brought her back to our show. Hello.
Hello.
What did the National Endowment for the Arts report about the number of Americans who are reading literary works?
Well, they suggested that there was that reading was at risk was the subtitle of their report, that in fact fewer people were reading, they were reading less literature. By literature, they meant works of imaginative writing, poetry and fiction.
And you put the word literary when you were describing their report in quotes.
Yes, that's right.
Because you're not necessarily in agreement with them as to what is literary?
I think literary is a way of reading rather than necessarily a body of work. I think that you can read that for one thing, one of the topics I take up in my book is the question of what wasn't literature and how things become literature and move in and out of that category. I think to read in a literary way, one could read the New York Times in a literary way. One could read certainly any kind of prose in a literary way, whether it was imaginative writing or not.
And our standards change. Writers of pulp fiction like Jim Thompson later become writers who some people want to add to the canon.
Well, or writers like Shakespeare of pulp fiction. As you probably know, when Shakespeare wrote these plays, they were thought of as riffraff, as baggage books, couldn't go in a serious library. Now they're the foundation of the canon.
And when novels were first developed, they were dismissed as things that were written for women.
Absolutely. And they were time-wasting. No serious person would take them on. They were also somehow morally suspect. Now, again, more people read novels than read poems in a normal day.
But it's still women, isn't it? I've read that that women read more literary fiction, using literary in the large sense, than men do.
Well, too bad for men, I think.
Is it true? Do you know?
The statistics from this report are from quite some time ago. It's hard to have an experiential sense of that. As a teacher, I can say that I have as many male students in my classes as female. I certainly in bookstores see male readers as well as female readers. I don't think these things break down along gender lines, even from author to author.
But when you say too bad for men, you're suggesting that there is a loss. Does reading literature affect behavior in a positive way?
I think it affects the behavior that we call reading. I don't think it necessarily affects how we behave toward other people or how we vote or where we choose to live or anything like that. I think literature is good to think with. I think that it enables you to think precisely and to read carefully and attentively and also with tremendous pleasure.
Wasn't there a Harris poll about what Americans like to read, what our favorite books are?
One of America's favorite books is always the Bible, for example, and it seems like a safe choice. But this, of course, opens up the big question of what do you mean by the Bible? Which translation do you mean and what parts of the Bible? And the idea that the Bible isn't one thing is a literary question.
Well, I see some people reading the Bible on the subway, but I see a lot more people reading Stieg Larsson.
Mm-hmm. Well, I
which think, is the, as far as I'm concerned, very far removed from the Bible.
Well, both have dramatic events. Both have traumatic activities. It's a matter of style, I think. And when people talk about the Bible, sometimes they talk about a belief structure. Sometimes they talk about a literary structure.
And what are some of the other books on the list?
America's favorite books.
Yeah.
Well, they're often books that people read in high school. It's things like The Catcher in the Rye or I'm trying to think of the To Kill a Mockingbird.
Mm-hmm.
These are books that people remember with great fondness and think of as the books that they were taught and therefore books that one should read.
It's like when people were asked what newspaper they read, everybody said the New York Times, even though the Daily News and the Post sold more newspapers.
Yes, that's true, that there's a certain kind of prestige value to naming something that people think is literature rather than something that you are reading.
Gone with the Wind, I understand, is another one of those books. Has everything changed now with the internet and with Kindles and e-books and all of the other things that have come along, and then video games and other sources of information. People not reading newspapers, but perhaps going to the Huffington Post or to the Drudge Report?
Well, that's reading too, I think. I remember that these changes have been incremental over time, that there was a time when very few people actually owned books, and they had to keep their own commonplace books, writing down wise sayings from other people's books that they'd heard read about out loud. Translations of things like the Bible made books more available to people. At every single moment over the history of print and reading, there's been a sense of alarm that somehow we're going to be losing something rather than gaining something. For me, the more venues for reading that are available on screen, digitally, or in the bookstore, the better.
And they're not competing with literature?
No, they are literature. They for one thing, you can buy
books.
You have
a broad definition of literature.
I have a both optimistic and skeptical definition of literature. That is to say, I think that it's hard to know in the moment what is going to endure and what is going to be a text that people study and return to. If you look at the history even of the 20th century of things that created scandals and then became canonical. I mean, think about Joyce's Ulysses or the text where there was some question about whether or not you really wanted to read them, the history of the metaphysical poets and how they were originally thought of as too complicated. And so that I think that what becomes literature is what has attracted attention and critical commentary and also things that people return to.
Well, you teach literature on a university level. If one of your students were to write a piece on Black Beauty, not being critical but just simply saying this is my favorite book, would that student be getting favor in your book? After all, it is literature.
It would depend upon what I had asked the student to do. If I asked the student to write about his or her favorite book and this was the favorite book, I would want them to have some evidence as to why it was favored. And they might be interested in whether or not it has always been in favor. There are – whether or not it's appreciative or analytical or critical, the things we say about literature need evidence, and I think the evidence is there.
The internet was – could be a source of a lot of literature, but what do you think of the court ruling that the Google book deal just went too far? Do you think that's helpful or unhelpful to literature?
I think it's helpful to readers, actually. I think that the idea of any monopoly – I'm following with great interest this business about the orphan books, for example. That is to say, books where they can't find the copyright holder, and so you don't know who has the right to benefit from a translation of it or from a transcription of it.
In the past, just any publisher could just publish a book that was in the public domain.
Well, I think it's good that Google wants to make these books available. I love the idea of a universal library. I love the idea of people not being – this is true worldwide, not just in for example, in the United States, that there are people who live very far away from access to books, and it's terrific to be able to read them.
I mentioned earlier that your definition of literature is quite inclusive, but hasn't the meaning of it changed over time? For example, Dr. Johnson – wrote of Milton, he had more than common literature.
I love that. I love the idea of having literature rather than knowing literature or producing literature. That meant that he was a well-read person and that his well-readness and his intellectual well-roundedness came from being familiar with other literary texts, with texts in many languages and with the works of many authors.
And that's kind of been abandoned. What about man of letters or belletrist? We don't see that much anymore either.
Well, belletrist, unfortunately, has become a word that sounds a little bit like dilettante or somebody only interested in style. Man of letters, we associate it with a kind of person of leisure who has, which we none of us are anymore, who has time to collect books and to discuss them. But I think there's a tremendous hunger among people to do exactly that, to buy books, to talk about them, to read them.
Well, I think if you would ask people what literature means, they might think in terms of being a person of letters. But literature has come to be used to mean brochures from the doctor's office.
Absolutely.
From a travel bureau. Here's some travel literature.
Exactly.
Here's some medical literature.
You might want to read this literature before you take the medicine. Absolutely.
That's not a debasement?
It's a debasement of the word. Literature comes from the word for letter or for printing, and it's what's happened to the notion of the concept of literature. That's really at the heart of what my book is about, to try to restore literature in a broader sense to the capacity to read culturally and to read with attention to language and to style.
Marjorie Garber's latest book is called The Use and Abuse of Literature, and it is published by Pantheon.
By Pantheon.
The use and abuse has been a favorite of writers for a long time. Nietzsche was the first one to use it?
Not the first by any means, I think, but certainly one of the most famous. The Use and Abuse of History for Life is one of the translations of his text. But you can find dozens of books called The Use and Abuse of Anything.
Yeah, but it's usually alcohol or tobacco and things like that these days.
That, but also use of an abuse of history, of theory, of can be low things or high things. It's a nice pairing, I think, use and abuse. I think what's interesting for me about the idea of use and abuse is that the use of literature for me is sometimes a certain kind of abuse, and the abuse of literature is sometimes a certain kind of use. And maybe I could say just a word about what I mean by that. What I feel very strongly is that literature is important in and of itself. It's what I call a first-order phenomenon. It doesn't need to be a handmaiden or a useful second-hand activity for other things like the practice of law or of medicine. I believe in legal humanities and medical humanities and so forth, but I don't think that the use of literature necessarily lies in its applicability to a moral or ethical problem. Raises these problems.
What do its roots tell us about how people intended it to be read?
You mean the individual author's intention?
No, literature.
I see. Well, it's
I assume it comes from Latin roots.
It has to do with that which is written, with letters. Mm-hmm. I don't think it has anything really to do with, the word itself evolves over time to become something that sounds like a kind of a canon. But the debates have not been so much about what is literature and what isn't literature, except for example in the pornography courts or in places or in the classroom. Should we teach this? Is it literature? It's not literature. It isn't worthy of teaching. The question of valuing things because they are literature is a kind of a snake chasing its own tail, I think.
Well, in recent years, we've had a lot of people asking whether the novel is dead, for example, which is not the same thing as asking whether the novel is useful.
Well, I remember, is painting dead too? These things, the minute something is declared dead, that's a good moment to look for its revival, it seems to me. And the novel will not be dead in my lifetime or in anybody's lifetime that I can think of. What is meant by that, I think, is that a certain kind of recognizable novel. The example that I use in the book actually is the well-made play. That something like that has – the plays today don't look like the old well-made plays of Sardou or even of a certain kind of Ibsen play. So does this mean that drama is dead? No, it means the drama is alive and living. And again, I feel very strongly that literary works are living things, that they change over time. They change with the times. They change as they are read. They change as the historical circumstances in which they're considered change.
But someone like V.S. Naipaul, who was a prominent novelist, has declared the novel dead. Now he says only nonfiction has any value.
Well, I was just recently the chair for the nonfiction panel of the National Book Award, and so I got to read 500 nonfiction books, and
have been painful.
No, it wasn't. It was deeply pleasurable. Actually, it was arduous, but it was not painful. But one of the things that you see is that the line between fiction and nonfiction is a somewhat spurious line, and the other thing that's so striking to me about this is that nonfiction is the biggest category. That why should the thing that Americans read most of be defined by what it isn't, by nonfiction, as if fiction were the norm here? But in fact, much that in a biography, much that's in a memoir, uses the same techniques and tactics that fiction does.
I think one of the big one of the arguments that Naipaul cites is that in the past we expected to see better writing in fiction than in nonfiction. Most cases, not all cases. And now he feels that writers of nonfiction are writing with wonderful styles and that we've seen a kind of a sameness within the fiction world.
Well, with respect, I'd say that is a kind of short view.
Many people disagree with them.
The nonfiction of Milton, of Dr. Johnson, of Francis Bacon is beautifully styled, and it's a long, long time ago. And very many of those essayists, people like, it's interesting if you go into a bookstore, you see that people are working on Montaigne again. They're working on people who write essays. They're very interested in the personal style of folks who invented the notion of the essay a long time ago. I've read a lot of novels recently that are not the same as one another. I think we're actually in a very productive moment for the creation of that which is literary.
What was it that Plato objected to in poetry?
Oh, well, the poetry was dangerous. It might indeed make things real to you that were not real. It might seduce. It might the dangers of fiction, the dangers of creation are very great, and so poets should be in fact banned from the ideal academy.
And then the alternate argument from someone like Matthew Arnold was that knowledge of literature, it was a way for social advancement.
Well, again, it's a long time span between Plato and Matthew Arnold. But Matthew Arnold precisely writing at a time of social change in Britain where he's looking for an alternative to an aristocratic heritage. What is this? The American version of this is meritocracy. But this is meritocracy through literature, through knowing what Arnold called the great touchstones of literature, being part of a conversation.
Although we don't expect that from our leaders today. There was a time when we assumed that people who had risen to positions of power and importance were well-read as well. Obviously, there were exceptions always. But today, we're surprised, in fact, when we discover that a president actually reads good books.
I that's true, and I think it's partly a matter of what the educational system expected of these people as they were coming through. People specialize much quicker these days. Sometimes it's not necessary to take courses in literature or the arts in any educational system as you're going through. I think, though, that we are the great debate during the last presidential election about whether Obama's eloquence made him too eloquent, and where this is the Platonic argument again that his language was seductive, and it promised, and it gave hope, and it was enchanting to listen to, as one used to say about John Kennedy, indeed. And was this itself dangerous because it was emotive as well as intellectual as well as emotive? I think that fine point between danger and pleasure is the space of the literary very often.
When we talk about literature having a use, are we also discussing literary scholarship and criticism?
I think we might be. For one thing, a lot of the great critics have become that which we now study, whether it's Dr. Johnson or Matthew Arnold, you mentioned, or Coleridge, or Virginia Woolf, T.S. Eliot, Susan Sontag, Edmund Wilson. We read these as primary texts, and we often go read what they are writing about, not because we were so interested in the past and letters in the case of Virginia Woolf or metaphysical poetry that T.S. Eliot is writing about, but because we are so moved by what they have to say about them, we're so impressed.
Well, people have also disagreed over what a critic should do and what the role of a critic is.
Mm-hmm.
Critics will often argue we are not issuing consumer reports, but people often read them in that way.
Well, the misreading is part of reading. Under and overreading are part of reading. I think critics precisely criticize. That is to say, they analyze and they offer assessment, and they often compare to other works of literature, other genres of literature. The word critic, interestingly, comes from the same word as the word crisis. And we often hear these days about a crisis in the humanities or a crisis in literature. And I think that this is a misunderstanding of the position that literature's always been in, and it's always been at a turning point. It's always changing.
Is their role to be an intermediary between the person who's made the art and the person who may very well be interested in approaching the art?
I think it's one pathway there. I think that very often very distinguished criticism sees things in a work of literature, we keep using that word, but in a poem or a play or a novel, that the author himself or herself only may see after it's pointed out critically, and that this second reading sometimes makes the work more accessible. But I don't think that authors necessarily need critics. I think that critics' work, again, I would say, is primary rather than secondary.
And I have found that critics have prejudiced me one way or the other toward a book, a film, or whatever,
mm-hmm.
Not always in a good way.
Well,
they've spoiled part of the experience.
I'm not sure that the answer, though, is to take a vow of abstinence as regards reading criticism or reading reviews or reading theory, but rather to read more, to see, you know, what are the critics' presuppositions as a writer, as an interpreter.
Well, but people are always telling us what we should and shouldn't read. That's how we've developed all these literary canons.
That's right.
Although one person's literary canon is different than another's, and I would assume that an American's literary canon would be different from someone from France, Japan, China, Spain, Russia, wherever.
Mm-hmm. Well, but again, that's not in itself a bad thing. Canon means judgment or collection of things in this way. And to if we begin by knowing a set of benchmarks, a set of works, then we will recognize other works which we haven't learned by using those things as models or as anti-models. This is the anti-novel. This is something that's not, I didn't expect from reading Dickens.
Well, when the American Great Books curricula were put together, who was it aimed at?
What was it? The Great Books curriculum of the 20s, the 30s, the 40s, but the Chicago one of the 50s. This is the post-war egalitarian gesture toward literary reading as making better citizens, as again people coming back from the war and using the GI Bill to go to college. There's a sense that this is not an elite practice, that the canon belongs to everyone. And that I like really Mortimer Adler's phrase, the great conversation, which he used about these books.
People complained that it was white male.
It was.
American or English language.
There are lots of things wrong with it. I've written about that myself. But that doesn't mean that it's a bad idea. These things, the opening up of the canon, the introduction of the women authors, of authors who are not British or American, this is crucial, obviously. And so I would say my other critique of the Great Books curriculum was that there wasn't enough criticism, that the idea was that there should be precisely an unmediated response to the text. Sometimes an unmediated response is not the only response that you could have.
More recently, we've had people argue about whether graphic novels could be considered literature.
I think graphic novels are a very good example of what once was not thought of to be literature at all. And in fact, people inveighed against the comic book as that which was ruining the morals of young Americans and they should be banned and so forth. And the graphic novel has come of age. It now is both beautiful and readable and reviewed in the New York Times and other places and quite respectfully so, and it should be. But this has been true of various literary genres over history.
Well, the Bible, for example, people teach the Bible as literature.
Right.
As opposed to the Bible, I guess, as religion.
I'm so interested in this word as in this connection. As opposed to what? Yes, exactly. As literature, teaching, the Declaration of Independence as literature. What this means to me is to, again, pay a certain kind of attention to language, to rhetoric, to grammar, to allusion, to pattern. And I think in that way, everything we read should be read as literature.
As opposed to the Word of God, in the case of the Bible as literature.
Well, that is a different purpose for the reading of the Bible and a different value for the reading of the Bible.
Marjorie Garber is the William R. Keenan Jr. Professor of English and of Visual and Environmental Studies at Harvard University, also chair of the program in Dramatic Arts. And she will be reading and signing books tonight at 7 at the Center for Fiction. That's at 17 East 47th Street. On the second floor. For more information on that and how to RSVP, go to our show page at wnyc.org. The book, The Use and Abuse of Literature, is published by Pantheon. Thank you so much for being with us today.
My great pleasure. Thank you for having me.